brine shrimp. The soup of shrimp and the smog of flies attracted millions of migratory waterfowl, a food source whose startling numbers were partially responsible for inducing some of the valley's first visitors to remain. The lake was alive with wild fowl, wrote Beveridge R. Speer, an Owens Valley pioneer. Ducks were by the square mile, millions of them. When they rose in flight, the roar of their wings could be heard 10 miles away. Occasionally, when shot down, a duck would burst open from fatness, which was butter yellow. The greater attraction, however, was the river. When whites arrived in the 1860s, Paiute Indians who had learned irrigation from the Spanish were already diverting some of the water to raise crops. In traditional pioneer fashion, the whites trumped up some cattle-rustling charges against the Indians, which appear to have led to the murder of a white woman and a child. The pious Owens Valley citizens then murdered at least 150 Paiutes in retaliation, driving the last 100 into Owens Lake to drown. They then took over the Indians' land, borrowed their irrigation methods, and began raising alfalfa and pasture and fruit. By 1899, they had established several ditch companies and had put some 40,000 acres under cultivation. The huge new silver camp at Tonopah, Nevada, consumed most of what the valley grew. With prosperity, several thriving towns sprang up: Bishop, Big Pine, Lone Pine, Independence. The irrigated valley was postcard pretty, a narrow swath of green in the middle of the high desert, with 14,495-foot Mount Whitney, the highest peak between Canada and Mexico, looming over Lone Pine and the river running through. Mark Twain came to visit, and Mary Austin, who was to become a well-known writer, came to live. But the entrance that most excited the valley people was that of the United States Reclamation Service, later renamed the Bureau of Reclamation. The service was an unparalleled experiment in federal intervention in the nation's economy, and was being watched so closely by skeptics in Congress that it could not afford to have any of its projects fail. To Frederick Newell, the first reclamation commissioner, the Owens Valley looked like a place where he could almost be guaranteed success. The people were proven irrigation farmers, a rarity in the non-Mormon West. The soil could grow anything that the climate would permit, the river was underused, and there was a good site for a reservoir. 60,000 additional acres were irrigable, and all of them could be gravity-fed. In early 1903, just a few months after the service was created, a team of reclamation engineers was already trooping around the valley, gauging stream flows and making soil surveys. 60,000 new acres would even make it worthwhile to run a railroad spur to Los Angeles. Los Angeles, everyone thought, was going to make the Owens Valley rich. Fred Eaton thought differently. Eaton had been born in Los Angeles in 1856. His family had founded Pasadena. Most of the Eaton men were engineers, and when they looked around them, it seemed that half of what they saw they had built themselves. It gave them an overpowering sense of pride in place. Fred had gone into hydrologic engineering, which is to say that he pretty much taught it to himself, and by the time he was 27, he was superintendent of the Los Angeles City Water Company. As San Francisco had bloomed into pseudo-Parisian splendor, Fred Eaton had chafed. When Los Angeles finally began to take on the appearance of a place with a future, he had been intensely proud. But he was one of the few people who understood that this whole promising future was an illusion. With artesian pressure still lifting fountainheads of water 8 feet into the air, no one believed that someday the basin would run out of water. Few understood that the occasional big floods in the Los Angeles River were testimony to the absence of rain, that the basin was normally so dry there wasn't enough ground cover to hold the rain when it fell. The annual flow of the Los Angeles River, that which ran above ground, represented only 0.5% of the runoff of the state, and because of the pumping the flow was dropping fast, from 100 cubic feet per second in the 1880s to 45 cubic feet per second in 1902. If growth continued, the population and the water would fall hopelessly out of balance. Everyone was living off tens of thousands of years of accumulated groundwater, like a spendthrift heir squandering his wealth. No one knew how much groundwater lay beneath the basin or how long it could be expected to last, but it would be insane to build the region's future on it. There was no other source of water nearby. Deserts lay on three sides of the basin, an ocean on the fourth. The nearest large rivers were the Colorado and the Kern, but to divert them out of their canyons to Los Angeles would require pumping lifts of thousands of feet, an impossibility at the time. It would also require a Herculean amount of energy. But there was, 250 miles away, the Owens River. It might not be quite sufficient for the huge metropolis forming in Eaton's imagination, but it was large enough. There was water for at least 1 million people. Indeed, Eaton was one of the few Los Angelians who knew the river even existed. Its distance from Los Angeles was staggering, but its remoteness was overshadowed by one majestically significant fact. Owens Lake, the terminus of the river, sat at an elevation of about 4,000 feet. Los Angeles was a few feet above sea level. The water, carried in pressure aqueducts and siphons, could arrive under its own power. Not 1 watt of pumping energy would be required. The only drawback was that the city might have to take the water by theft. During their years together at the Los Angeles City Water Company, Fred Eaton and Bill Mulholland became good friends, thriving on each other's differences. Eaton was a Western patrician, smooth and diffident. Mulholland, an Irish immigrant with a musician's repertoire of ribald stories and a temperament like a bear's. Eaton thought so much of Mulholland that he groomed him to be his successor, and when Eaton left the company in 1886 to pursue a career in politics and seek his fortune, Mulholland was named superintendent. In the years that followed, Fred Eaton would become messianic about the water shortage he saw approaching. The only answer, he told Mulholland, was to get the Owens River. At first, Mulholland found the idea preposterous. Going 250 miles for water was out of the question, and Mulholland didn't much believe in surface water development anyway. Damming rivers meant forming reservoirs, and in the heat and dryness of California, reservoirs would evaporate huge quantities of water. It made more sense to slow down the rainfall as it returned to the ocean and force more of it into the aquifer. Mulholland preached soil and forest conservation 30 years before its time. He wanted to seed the whole basin, and when he said that the deforestation of the mountainsides would reduce the basin's water supply, everyone thought he was slightly nuts. He had his men filling gullies and installing infiltration galleries and check dams all over the place. Everything he did, however, was nullified by the basin's growth. By 1900, Los Angeles's population had gone over 100,000. It doubled again within 4 years. During the same period, the city experienced its first severe drought. Even with lawn watering prohibited and park ponds left unfilled, the artesian pressure, as Eaton had predicted, began to drop. Gushes became gurgles, then dried up. Pumps were frantically installed. By 1904, the pressure was low enough to prompt Mulholland to begin shutting irrigation wells in the San Fernando Valley, which lay across the Hollywood Hills and fed both the aquifer and the river. The farmers were furious, and Mulholland began spending a lot of time in court. The Los Angeles City Water Company was eventually taken over by the city, and Mulholland was retained in command. The city didn't have much choice in the matter. Mulholland was such a seat-of-the-pants engineer that the plan of the entire water system resided mainly in his head. The most elemental schematics and blueprints did not exist. In late 1904, the newly created Los Angeles Department of Water and Power issued its first public report. "The time has come," it said, "when we shall have to supplement the supply from some other source." With that simple statement, William Mulholland was about to become a modern Moses. But instead of leading his people through the waters to the promised land, he would cleave the desert and lead the promised waters to them. There is a widely held view that Los Angeles simply went out to the Owens Valley and stole its water. In a technical sense, that isn't quite true. Everything the city did was legal, though its chief collaborator, the U.S. Forest Service, did indeed violate the law. Whether one can justify what the city did, however, is another story. Los Angeles employed chicanery, subterfuge, spies, bribery, a campaign of divide and conquer, and a strategy of lies to get the water it needed. In the end, it milked the valley bone dry, impoverishing it, while the water made a number of prominent Los Angelians very, very rich. There are those who would argue that if all of this was legal, then something is the matter with the law. It could never have happened, perhaps, had the ingenuous citizens of the Owens Valley paid more attention to a small news item that appeared in the Inyo Register, the valley's largest newspaper, on September 29, 1904. The item began, "Fred Eaton, ex-mayor of Los Angeles, and Fred Mulholland, who is connected with a water system of that city, arrived a few days ago and went up to the site of the proposed government dam on the Owens River." The person who took them around, the story continued, was Joseph Lippincott, the regional engineer for the Reclamation Service. It wasn't so much the small piece of news that should have aroused the valley's suspicions. It was the fact that Lippincott had already taken Eaton around the valley twice before. The valley had no particular reason to distrust J.B. Lippincott, although a search into his background would have dredged up a revelation or two. As a young man out of engineering school, he had joined John Wesley Powell's Irrigation Survey, the first abortive attempt to launch a federal reclamation project in the West, but had lost his job soon thereafter when Congress denied Powell funding. Embittered by the experience, Lippincott migrated to Los Angeles, where, by the mid-1890s, he had built up a lucrative practice as a consulting engineer. In 1902, when the Reclamation Service was finally created, its first commissioner, Frederick Newell, immediately thought of Lippincott as the person to launch its California program. He had a good reputation, and he understood irrigation, a science few engineers were familiar with. The post, however, meant a substantial cut in salary, and Lippincott insisted on being allowed to maintain a part-time engineering practice on the side. Newell and his deputy, Arthur Powell Davis, who was John Wesley Powell's nephew, were a little wary. In a fast-growing region with little water, a district engineer with divided loyalties could lead the service into a thicket of conflict of interest entanglements. The centerpiece of the service's program in California was to be the Owens Valley Project, and there were already rumors that Los Angeles coveted the valley's water. One of the service's engineers, in fact, had raised this issue with Davis, with Lippincott, a son of Los Angeles, in charge. A collision between the city and the service over the Owens River might leave the city with the water and the service absent its reputation. But the service's early leadership, unlike those who succeeded them, suffered from a certain lack of imagination. "On the face of it," Davis scoffed, "such a project is as likely as the city of Washington tapping the Ohio River." The only person who seemed suspicious when Lippincott began showing Eaton and Mulholland around the Owens Valley again and again was one of his own employees, a young Berkeley-educated engineer named Jacob Clausen. His apprehensions had been aroused during Eaton's second visit, when Lippincott and Eaton had ridden up to the valley from Los Angeles by way of Tioga Pass, and Clausen, at Lippincott's request, had met them at Mono Lake. On the way down the valley, Lippincott insisted that they stop at the ranch of Thomas Rickey, one of the biggest landowners in the valley. Rickey's ranch was in Long Valley, an occluded shallow gorge of the Owens River, hard up against the giant Sierra Massif, which contained the reservoir site the Reclamation Service would have to acquire in order for its project to be feasible. Eaton had told Clausen that he wanted to become a cattle rancher and was interested in buying Rickey's property if he was willing to sell. As they visited the ranch, however, he seemed much more interested in water than in cattle. Clausen understood the dynamics of the Owens Valley project, the stream flows, the water rights, the interaction of ground and surface water, better than anyone, and Lippincott asked him to explain to Eaton how the project would work. Eaton hung on his every word, And that, Clausen was to testify later, was exactly what Lippincott wanted. The two Los Angelians were good friends, and Eaton had been the first to dream of Los Angeles going to the Owens Valley for water. Was it so far-fetched, Clausen would remember thinking to himself, to believe that Lippincott was out to help Los Angeles steal the valley's water? If Clausen's suspicions were aroused, those of his high superiors remained utterly dormant, even though they would soon have equal reason to suspect Lippincott of being a double agent for Los Angeles. In early March of 1905, Lippincott had sent his entire engineering staff to Yuma, Arizona, on the Colorado River, to move the Yuma Irrigation Project forward at a faster pace. Work on the Owens Valley Project had been held up by winter and by the delayed arrival of a piece of drilling equipment which was on order. During the hiatus, the Reclamation Service received a couple of applications for rights of way across federal lands from two newly formed power companies in the Owens Valley. Each was interested in building a hydroelectric project, and Lippincott had to decide which, if any, of the plans would coexist with the reclamation project. Unable or unwilling to look into the matter himself, Lippincott might have waited for one of his engineers to return later in the spring, but he wanted to dispose of the issue, so he decided to appoint a consulting engineer to look into the matter for him. And though there were dozens of engineers in Los Angeles and San Francisco among whom he could have chosen, he decided to turn to his old friend and professional associate, Fred Eaton. The news that Lippincott had hired Fred Eaton to decide on a matter that could affect the whole Owens Valley project left his superiors stunned. But their response, typically, was one of bafflement rather than anger. "I fail to understand in what capacity he is acting," was the only response Arthur Davis managed to give. Eaton himself had no questions about the capacity in which he was acting, though the public face he presented was very different. With his letter of introduction from Lippincott and an armload of freshly minted reclamation maps, he strode into the government land office in Independence, claiming to represent the service on a matter of vital importance to the Owens Valley project. For the first 3 days, however, his investigations had nothing to do with the hydroelectric plans. Poring over land deeds in the office's files, deeds to which he might have had no access as a private citizen, Eaton jotted down a wealth of information on ownership, water rights, stream flows, things Los Angeles had to know if and when it decided to move on the Owens Valley water. Handsome and charming, Eaton even managed to get the land office employees to help him, unaware that the information they were digging out had nothing to do with a matter that had allegedly brought Eaton there. When he finally had what he felt he needed, he turned to the official matter at hand. The problem of the conflicting power license applications was straightforward. There could only be one resolution. One of the two power companies, the Owens River Water and Power Company, held water rights senior to those of its competitor, the Nevada Power Mining and Milling Company. Its rights even predated those of the Reclamation Service, and if it was refused its application, it might cause the service some real legal embarrassment. In addition, its plan of development was far more compatible with the Reclamation Project than the Nevada Company's. Jacob Clausen had taken a cursory look at both and decided that the Nevada Company's project could reduce the Long Valley Reservoir to a glorified mudflat during the peak summer irrigation season when water was needed most. To Clausen, the applications were hardly worth a second look, and he couldn't understand why Lippincott had even bothered to hire someone to review them so carefully. The Owens River Company deserved a conditional go-ahead. The Nevada Company decidedly did not. But Clausen was far too naive to understand the complexity of such matters. One of the founders of and partners in the Nevada Power Mining and Milling Company was a rancher named Thomas B. Rickey. Eaton's baffling recommendation in favor of the Nevada Power Mining and Milling Company threw Clausen into a state of apoplexy. When Lippincott formally endorsed his judgment a few weeks later, Clausen finally understood that something was terribly wrong, but how wrong even he could not fathom. On the 6th of March, exactly 3 days after Lippincott had hired Eaton as his personal representative in the matter of the power company applications, the city of Los Angeles had quietly hired its own consultant to prepare a report on the options it had in its search for water. The report had taken only a couple of weeks to prepare. Most of the information was in Mulholland's office, and the conclusion was foregone anyway, and the consultant had received an absurdly grandiose commission of $2,500, more than half his annual salary. It was not so much a commission as a bribe. The money, however, was well spent. The name of the consultant was Joseph B. Lippincott. One other person besides Jacob Clausen had begun to follow the comings and goings of Eaton, Lippincott, and Mulholland with more than detached interest. Wilfred Watterson, the president of the Inyo County Bank. Wilfred and his brother, Mark, were the most popular citizens in the Owens Valley. Their family had founded the bank, and Wilfred and Mark, when still in their 20s, became president and treasurer. Both were attractive young men, but Wilfred in particular was strikingly handsome. He had clean-cut, perfect features, an absolutely even gaze, and the erect, confident air of a 19th-century optimist. In his elegant clothes, Wilfred could have passed easily for Bat Masterson instead of a small-town banker. The lending policies of the Inyo County Bank were as much of an aberration as its owners. The Wattersons rarely refused a loan and often stretched out debts. They displayed a strong interest in the valley's survival and a casual, almost careless attitude toward money. Wilfred's suspicions that Los Angeles was engineering a water grab had begun to simmer when word got around that Fred Eaton, the would-be cattle rancher, was offering some astonishingly generous sums for land with good water rights. There were stories that Eaton would make an offer that already seemed generous, and if a landowner gambled and tried to raise him, Eaton would readily meet his terms. It was hard for Wilfred to nail any of this down, because no one wanted to let the Wattersons know that he was thinking of selling out, not after they had loaned money with such abandon up and down the valley. But the stories were enough to make Wilfred skeptical about Eaton's true intentions. Was he rich enough to pay those prices? Where did he get the money? Watterson's suspicions became intensely aroused one day in the early summer of 1905, when an unidentified young man arrived in the valley, went directly to the Inyo Bank, and displayed a written order from Fred Eaton to pick up a parcel in a safe deposit box. As soon as he had it in his hand, the young man left with unseemly haste and stalked down the street in the direction of the post office. Watterson sprang up from his desk and asked the teller who the man was. He was Harry Leland, the Los Angeles city clerk, the official legally charged with handling any transactions for the city that involved transfers of water or land. Watterson burst out the door and ran down the street in the direction in which Leland had disappeared. He found him across the street from the post office. Watterson ambled up to Leland, accosted him in his disarming manner, and said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Leland, but there's a small formality we forgot to carry out at the bank." Leland looked perplexed. Watterson asked him to follow him back to the bank. Once they were safely inside the president's office, Watterson offered the clerk a seat and some coffee, then walked casually to the door and locked it. "We want the deed back," he said. Leland looked stricken. "What deed do you mean?" he asked. "The deed by which your city is going to try to rape this valley," Watterson answered. "I haven't any idea what you're talking about." "Maybe this will help," said Watterson. He opened his desk drawer, removed a revolver, and put it on top of the desk. Leland's mouth opened. "I can't give you something I don't have," he begged. Watterson stood up and hovered menacingly over the clerk. "Take off your coat and trousers," he said. Leland, badly frightened, obliged. Watterson turned all of his pockets inside out and found nothing. He ordered Leland to get dressed and take him to his room at the Hotel Bishop. "Eaton's been buying land in an underhanded way to secure water for the city of Los Angeles, hasn't he?" Watterson said to Leland on the way over. He was inventing the theory as he walked, but Leland's agonized expression told him he was right. "You've paid high prices not because you're dumb, but because you're smart. You're masquerading as investors, and all you're going to invest in is our ruin." Leland kept insisting that he didn't know what Watterson was talking about. At the hotel, Watterson nearly tore apart his room, but found none of the documents Leland had extracted from Eaton's box. It was obvious that Leland had been so fearful of being discovered that he had immediately run to the post office and mailed the deed. Without the document, Watterson had nothing to go on but his hunches, and he was forced to let Leland go. But his temper notwithstanding, he knew he would have to let him go anyway. The clerk had done nothing against the law. Neither, from what he knew, had Eaton. Was it possible, Watterson asked himself, that a distant city could destroy the valley he and his family had worked so hard and gambled so recklessly to build up and never step outside the law? Meanwhile, the $2,500 contract accepted by Joseph Lippincott from Los Angeles was, if not exactly illegal, an apparent violation of the most basic ethical standards for government officials. Newell had let Lippincott off with another fatherly lecture, but everyone in the Reclamation Service had heard about it, and since the service had been created as an answer to the epic graft and fraud associated with the General Land Office, some of Lippincott's associates were furious with him. By July of 1905, Newell realized that the whole thing might blow up in his face. He had to do something to contain the damage. As a result, he decided to appoint a panel of engineers to review the conflict between the reclamation project and the water needs of Los Angeles and decide whether the Owens Valley project should move forward, be put on hold, or be abandoned. Newell felt that Lippincott, as the senior engineer most familiar with the project, should sit on the panel. To his and Lippincott's astonishment, several reclamation engineers said they would refuse to sit next to him. Lippincott now realized that he, too, would have to mount a damage control operation in a hurry. On July 26th, the night before the panel was scheduled to convene, he dashed off a telegram to Eaton that read, "Reported to me and publicly accepted that you had represented yourself as connected with the reclamation and acting as my agent in Owens Valley. As this is entirely erroneous and very embarrassing to me, please deny publicly or the service will be forced to do so." The truth of Lippincott's denial can best be judged by Fred Eaton's reaction, which was incendiary. He received the telegram in the Federal Land Office in Independence, where he was still trying to masquerade as Lippincott's agent. After reading it, he felt compelled to vent his spleen on the nearest person available, Agent Richard Fish. "Eaton said he had a telegram for Mr. Lippincott, and it was a damned hot one," said Fish later in a deposition, "and he, Eaton, did not like it a little bit, as it put him in a wrong light." Newell's panel of engineers was convened in San Francisco on July 27th. After 2 days of hearing divided opinions, Clausen testified in favor in continuing, Lippincott in favor of abandonment, the panel reached a unanimous verdict. "The Owens Valley project should not be sedulously pursued," they recommended. "The needs of Los Angeles had become too great an issue. But neither should it be formally abandoned until a more persuasive case could be made for doing so. Los Angeles would have to demonstrate that it had absolutely no choice but to go to the valley for water, and it would have to prove that it had the resources to carry out such a gigantic undertaking on its own. Such a recommendation," the panel added, "was of course based on the assumption that the reclamation project was still feasible." Which, unbeknownst to anyone but Eaton and a select handful of Los Angeles officials, it was not. 4 months earlier, after completing his consultant duties for Lippincott, Eaton had gone back to see the stubborn Thomas Rickey, who held a key piece of land in the valley, the land the city had to have in order to block the federal project, but who had refused to sell. In Eaton's hand was his recommendation that Rickey's hydroelectric company be allowed to usurp its competitor's claim on the main power sites on the river. That, Eaton thought, was the sweetener that would surely make Rickey sell. After hours of pleading and cajoling, however, the rancher still held out. In disgust, Eaton finally stood up, roughly shook Rickey's hand, and stomped out the door. As he was standing at the railroad depot, waiting for the train that would take him back to Los Angeles, Ricky raced up in his carriage. He had had a sudden change of heart. For $450,000, he told Eaton, he would sell him an option clear on the ranch, including the Long Valley Reservoir site. Eaton's jubilation was so great he couldn't restrain himself. He ran to the telegraph office and shot off a cryptic message to Mulholland. "The deal is made," he wired. All it had required was a week of Italian work. Los Angeles now had most of what it needed, but Mulholland still wanted some additional water rights in order to kill the reclamation project once and for all. Within hours of receiving Eaton's telegram, he was frantically organizing an expedition of prominent Los Angelians to the Owens Valley, using the pretext that they were investors interested in developing a resort. The group included Mayor Owen McAleer and two prominent members of the Water Commission. For them to see the river firsthand was crucial, Mulholland reasoned, because he and Eaton would need more money to buy the last water rights they wanted, and the city could not legally appropriate money toward a project that hadn't even been described, let alone authorized. A group such as this could easily free up some money in the Los Angeles business community if they fathomed how much water there was. It went exactly as planned. The group arrived in the valley on the cusp of spring, when even small tributaries of the Owens River were overflowing. Days after they returned, Eaton and Mulholland had all the money they needed. They requisitioned an automobile and raced off to the valley by the shortest route, across the Mojave Desert, probably the first time anyone crossed it by car. After a week of frantic, furtive buying, the two men returned. "The last spike has been driven," Mulholland announced to the assembled water commissioners. "The options are all secured." Like all the other newspaper publishers in the city, Harrison Gray Otis had been operating under a self-imposed gag rule. Although the publishers knew what was going on, not a word of Mulholland and Eden's stealthy grab of water options had appeared in the papers. However, on July 29th, the same day the reclamation panel reached its verdict, Otis could no longer contain himself. Under a headline that read, "Titanic Project to Give the City a River," the whole unauthorized story spilled out in the Los Angeles Times. Otis seemed to take particular satisfaction in the way Fred Eaton had hoodwinked the greedy but guileless rubes in the Owens Valley. "A number of the unsuspecting ranchers have regarded the appearance of Mr. Eaton in the valley as a visitation of Providence," the Times chortled. "In the eyes of the ranchers, he was land mad. When they advanced the price of their holdings a few $100 and he stood the raise, their cup of joy fairly overflowed. The farmer folk in the Owens River Valley think that he has gone daffy on stock raising. To them, he is a millionaire with a fad." The paper even admitted that the town of Independence, whose neighboring ranchers had been made offers they couldn't refuse, was faced with financial ruin. But it refused to let such a fact spoil its enjoyment of a good joke. The paper also recalled in excruciating detail Joseph Lippincott's career as a double agent, apparently thinking it was doing him a favor. "In the consummation of the great project that is to supply Los Angeles with sufficient water for all time, great credit is given to J.B. Lippincott," it said. "Without Mr. Lippincott's interest and cooperation, it is declared that the plan never would have gone through. Guided by the spirit of the Reclamation Act, he recognized the fact that the Owens River water would fulfill a greater mission in Los Angeles than if it were to be spread over acres of desert land. Any other government engineer, a non-resident of Los Angeles and not familiar with the needs of this section, undoubtedly would have gone ahead with nothing more than the mere reclamation of the arid lands in view." It was praise that was to damn Lippincott for the rest of his life. There was nothing quite as revealing in the Times story, however, as its very lead sentence. "The cable that has held the San Fernando Valley vassal for 10 centuries to the arid demon," it gushed in a spasm of metaphorical excess, "is about to be severed by the magic scimitar of modern engineering skill." There was something very strange about that sentence. All along, the Owens River had been portrayed as a matter of life or death to the city of Los Angeles. No one had ever said a word about the San Fernando Valley. sesquipedalian tergiversation was the strong suit of Harrison Gray Otis, along with slander, meanness, biliousness, and the implacable pursuit of a good old-fashioned grudge. Under his ownership, the Times was less a newspaper than a kind of mace used to bludgeon and destroy his enemies, who and which were many. Otis often said that he considered objectivity a form of weakness. The Democratic Party was a shameless old harlot. Labor leaders were corpse defacers, labor unions anarchic scum. California's preeminent reformer, governor, later senator, Hiram Johnson, was a born mob leader, a whooper, a howler, a roarer. The newspaper owned by Otis's former partner, H.H. Boyce, was the Daily Morning Metropolitan bellyache, while Boyce himself was a coarse, vulgar criminal. William Randolph Hearst and his Examiner, more serious rivals than Boyce, were interchangeably Yellow Yawp. Even innocent bystanders were vaporized by the general's ire. One morning, Otis was greeted by a new neighbor who happened to mispronounce his name. "Good morning, General Otis," said the man cheerily. "It's Otis, you goddamn fool," the general bellowed back. General Harrison Gray Otis. Otis's military coronation had come through the offices of President William McKinley as a reward for volunteering to send young men into the Philippine jungles during the Spanish-American War. By the time he returned to the States, the 20th century had dawned, and Otis was utterly unprepared for it. Unions were organizing, the open shop was threatened, and even in Los Angeles, the socialists, were getting ready to run a candidate for mayor. Anti-unionism became breakfast fare for Times readers as predictable as sunrise, and Otis was soon ordained public enemy number one by organized labor in the United States, no mean feat for a newspaper publisher in a remote western city. It was a notoriety he loved. To celebrate it, Otis commissioned a new headquarters that resembled a medieval fortress. It even had a parapet with turrets and cannon slots, and had a custom touring car built with a cannon mounted on the hood. The effect of all this on his enemies was inspirational. Hiram Johnson was addressing a crowd in a Los Angeles auditorium when someone in the audience, who knew that Johnson's talent for invective surpassed even the general's, yelled out, "What about Otis?" Johnson, all prognathous scowl and murderous intent, took two steps forward and began extemporaneously. "In the city of San Francisco we have drunk to the very dregs of infamy," he said in a low rumble. "We have had vile officials. We have had rotten newspapers. But we have had nothing so vile, nothing so low, nothing so debased, nothing so infamous in San Francisco as Harrison Gray Otis. He sits there in senile dementia with gangrene heart and rotting brain, grimacing at every reform, chattering impotently at all the things that are decent, frothing, fuming, violently gibbering, going down to his grave in snarling infamy. This man, Otis, is the one blot on the banner of Southern California. He is the bar sinister on your escutcheon. My friends, he is the one thing that all Californians look at when in looking at Southern California they see anything that is disgraceful, depraved, corrupt, crooked, and putrescent. That," concluded Johnson in a majestic bawl, "that is Harrison Gray Otis." The vitriol that Otis and his rivals hurled at one another, however, could be turned off instantly if some more important matter was at hand. In the avaricious social climate of Southern California, that usually meant an opportunity to make money. And in the dry climate of Southern California, money meant water. The first sign something was afoot came in the weeks following the Times' disclosure of Mulholland and Eaton's daring scheme, when Otis's newspaper took time out from its usual broadsides to laud the future of the San Fernando Valley, an encircled plain of dry, mostly worthless land on the other side of the Hollywood Hills. "Go to the whole length and breadth of the San Fernando Valley these dry August days," the paper editorialized on August 1st. "Shut your eyes and picture the same scene after a big river of water has been spread over every acre, after the whole expanse has been cut up into 5-acre and in some cases 1-acre plots, plots with a pretty cottage on each and with luxuriant fruit trees, shrubs, and flowers in all the glory of their perfect growth. Again, on October 10th, a so-called news story began, "Premonitory pains and twitches. The San Fernando Valley has caught the boom. It appears just about ready to break." What was odd about this was that there was as yet no guarantee, at least none publicly offered by Mulholland, that the San Fernando Valley was going to receive any of the Owens Valley water. In the first place, the route of the aqueduct had not yet been disclosed. It might go through the valley, but then again it might not. Secondly, the voters had not even approved the aqueduct, let alone voted for a bond issue to finance it. Mulholland had been saying that the city had surplus water sufficient for only 10,000 new arrivals. If that was so, and if the city was expected to grow by hundreds of thousands during the next decade, where was this great surplus for the San Fernando Valley to come from? In those days, the valley was isolated from Los Angeles proper. It sat by itself, far outside the city limits. In theory, the valley couldn't even have the city's surplus water, assuming there was any. It would be against the law. The truth, which only a handful of people knew, was that William Mulholland's private figures were grossly at odds with his public pronouncements. It was the same with his intentions. Despite his talk of water for only 10,000 more people, there was still a big surplus at hand. During the 8 years it would take to complete the aqueduct, in fact, the population of Los Angeles rose from 200,000 to 500,000 people, yet no water crisis occurred. The crisis was, in large part, a manufactured one, created to instill the public with a sense of panic and help Eaton acquire a maximum number of water rights in the Owens Valley. Mulholland and Eaton had managed to secure water rights along 40 miles of the Owens River, which would be enough to give the city a huge surplus for years to come. But Mulholland was not saying that he would use any of the surplus. In fact, he seemed to be going out of his way to assure the Owens Valley that he would not. For example, the proposed intake for the aqueduct had been carefully located downstream from most of the Owens Valley ranches and farms so that they could continue to irrigate. Mulholland would later tell the valley people that his objective was simply to divert their unused and returned flows. In truth, Mulholland planned to divert every drop to which the city held rights as soon as he could. Like all water-conscious Westerners, he lived in fear of the use-it-or-lose-it principle in the doctrine of appropriative rights. If the city held water rights that went unused for years, the Owens Valley people might successfully claim them back. But where would he allow the surplus to be used? Privately, Mulholland planned to lead the aqueduct through the San Fernando Valley on its way to the city. In his hydrologic scheme of things, the valley was the best possible receiving basin. Any water dumped on the earth there would automatically drain into the Los Angeles River and its broad aquifer, creating a large, convenient, non-evaporative pool for the city to tap. It provided, in a word, free storage. That it was free was critically important, because Mulholland, intentionally or not, had underestimated the cost of building the aqueduct, and to build a large storage reservoir in addition to the aqueduct would be out of the question financially. Even had it been feasible, Mulholland was deeply offended by the evaporative waste of reservoirs. He was much more inclined to store water underground. Mulholland had an even more important reason for wanting to include the San Fernando Valley in his scheme. Under the city charter, Los Angeles was prohibited from incurring a debt greater than 15% of its assessed valuation. In 1905, that put its debt limit at exactly $23 million, which was what he expected the aqueduct to cost. But the city already had $7 million in outstanding debt, which left him with a debt ceiling too low to complete the project. After coming this far, securing the water rights, organizing civic support, he wouldn't have the money to build it. Mulholland, however, was clever enough to have thought of a way out of this dilemma. If the assessed valuation of Los Angeles could be rapidly increased, its debt ceiling would be that much higher. And what better way was there to accomplish this than to add to the city? Instead of bringing more people to Los Angeles, which was happening anyway, the city would go to them. It would just loosen its borders as Mulholland loosened his silk cravat and wrap itself around the San Fernando Valley. Then it would have a new tax base, a natural underground storage reservoir, and a legitimate use of its surplus water in one fell swoop. Anyone who knew this and bought land in the San Fernando Valley while it was still dirt cheap stood to become very, very rich. The person who finally began to figure it all out was Henry Lowenthal, the editor of Otis's despised rival newspaper, William Randolph Hearst's Examiner. The Examiner had been skeptical of the aqueduct plan from the beginning, though it did not oppose it outright. Lowenthal's editorials merely made a point of questioning Mulholland's sense of urgency and, on occasion, his figures. But even such mild skepticism was more than enough to enrage Otis, who attributed Lowenthal's doubts to the fact that the Times had scooped the Examiner about the aqueduct story. Anyone but a simpleton or a poor old has-been in his dotage would sing very low over a failure like that, snarled Otis in an editorial. But the impossible Lowenthal insists on emphasizing his own incompetency. Such invective simply instilled in Lowenthal a passionate urge to outscoop Otis, and in the process catch him with his hand in the till. There must be some hanky-panky, Lowenthal surmised. Otherwise, why Otis's sudden interest in a desolate valley? And why did Otis's number one enemy, E.T. Earle, rival publisher of the Express, seem as enthusiastic as Otis? In the past, Earle had opposed nearly anything Otis endorsed, and vice versa, as a simple matter of dignity. But now Otis, Earle, and virtually all the rival newspapers, except his own, were united on perhaps the most controversial issue Los Angeles had ever faced. Why? Lowenthal decided to send a couple of his top reporters to the courthouse in San Fernando to find out. The co-conspirators hadn't even bothered to cover their tracks. They could have invented blind trusts, paper corporations, or some other ruse to conceal their identity, but there they were, caught in the open, on an exposed plain. On November 28, 1904, just 6 days after Joseph Lippincott was paid $2,500 to help steer his loyalties in the direction of Los Angeles, a syndicate of private investors had purchased a $50,000 option on the Porter Land and Water Company, which owned the greater part of the San Fernando Valley, 16,000 acres, all told. Innocent enough. But the investors had then waited to consummate their $500,000 purchase until March 23, 1905, the same day that Fred Eaton had telegraphed the Water Commission that the option on the Rickey Ranch in Long Valley was secured. On that day, as anyone who had access to Mulholland's thinking knew, Los Angeles was all but guaranteed 250,000 acre-feet of new water, an amount that would leave the city with a water surplus for at least another 20 years. And the only sensible place to use the surplus water was in the San Fernando Valley. Was the timing mere coincidence? The names of the investors who made up the secret land syndicate strongly suggested that it was not. In fact, their identity had given Lowenthal the scoop of his dreams. The only way he could improve its impact was to wait for exactly the right moment to go to press. Lowenthal knew that the San Francisco Chronicle was, in a vague way, onto the same story. He also knew the Chronicle was not nearly as methodical in its investigation as his paper, and would probably publish rumors without supporting facts. On August 22nd, just as Lowenthal supposed, the Chronicle ran a story, unsupported by evidence, to the effect that the Owens Valley Aqueduct was somehow linked to a land development scheme in the San Fernando Valley. 2 days later, the Times derisively dismissed the allegations in an editorial which, to Lowenthal's delight, ran under the heading Baseless Rumors. On the same morning, the Examiner's story went to press. The San Fernando Land Syndicate, the Examiner revealed, was composed of some of the most influential and wealthy men in Los Angeles. There was Moses Sherman, a balding school administrator from Arizona who had moved to Los Angeles and become a trolley magnate, one of the most ruthless capitalists in a city that was legendary for same. By coincidence, Moses Sherman also sat on the Board of Water Commissioners of Los Angeles. The syndicate could not have prayed for a better set of eyes and ears. Then there was Henry Huntington, Sherman's implacable rival in the rush to monopolize the region's transportation system. There was Edward Harriman, the chairman of the Union Pacific Railroad and a rival of both Sherman and Huntington. There was Joseph Sartori of the Security Trust and Savings Bank, and his rival, L.C. Brand of the Title Guarantee and Trust Company. There was Edwin T. Earle, the publisher of the Express, William Kirchhoff, a local power company magnate, and Harry Chandler, Otis's son-in-law, the tubercular young man with the minister's face, the gambler's heart, and the executioner's soul. But Lowenthal reserved the best for last. The person who had signed the check securing the $50,000 option on the immense San Fernando property was the same person who, that very morning, had dismissed talk of such a nest of land speculators as lies, Brigadier General Harrison Gray Otis. This is the prize for which the newspaper persons are working, and the size of it accounts for their tremendous zeal, wrote Lowenthal, almost squealing with delight. The mystery of the enterprise is how it happens that Messrs. Huntington and Harriman, who let no one into their previous land-purchasing schemes, but who bought up everything for themselves, consented to let the other in. Lowenthal was, of course, enough of a cynic to know exactly why they had. The participants, taken together, represented the power establishment of Southern California with an exquisite sense of proportion. Railroads, banking, newspapers, utilities, land development. It was a monopolist's version of affirmative action. Besides, William Kirchhoff was a prominent conservation and friend of Gifford Pinchot, the chief of the U.S. Forest Service, whose influence with President Theodore Roosevelt could prove invaluable. Harriman's railroad owned 100 miles of right-of-way along the aqueduct path that the city would need permission to cross, and Huntington owned the building that housed the regional headquarters of the Reclamation Service. Including Earl and Otis, the two feuding neighbors and publishers, was the masterstroke. Like a couple of convicts bound together by a ball and chain, neither could betray the other without exposing himself. The Examiner's exposé had Harrison Gray Otis venting steam from both nostrils and ears, but he didn't dare look the accusations directly in the eye. So in the ensuing weeks he tried to hide behind Mr. Huntington's skirts, as if Huntington had been solely responsible for the syndicate and he, Otis, had been an innocent, seduced into joining as a fresh young wayward girl is seduced into sex. Where Otis couldn't weasel out, he blazed away. Had Hearst's yellow atrocity been the first to announce the plans of the Water Board, it would have claimed the project as its own conception and inauguration, he raved. Its front page would have shrieked in poster type about the Examiner's solution to the water problem, and the public would have been deafened with yawp about how the Examiner discovered Owens River, laid out plans to bring the water to Los Angeles, and showed the engineers how to build the aqueduct. The line would have been dubbed the Great Hearst Aqueduct, or the Examiner Pipeline, and Lowenthal the Impossible would have been the Moses of Los Angeles, who smote the rock of Mount Whitney with the rod of his egotism and caused the water to flow abundantly. Deprived of the opportunity for mendacious self-glorification, the foolish freak vents its impotent rage in snarling under its breath. The insane desire of the Examiner to discredit certain citizens of Los Angeles has at last led it into the open, as a vicious enemy of the city's welfare, its mask of hypocrisy dropped and its convulsed features revealed. In the end, though, the broadsides between the rival papers were all sound and fury, signifying not much. Ever since their foremost minister had fled prosecution for land fraud, the citizens of Los Angeles had grown accustomed to scandal, and the city's temperament was quite comfortable with graft. Henry Lowenthal would later speak of a spirit of lawlessness that prevails here that I have never seen anywhere else. Nature was also smiling on the Owens Valley scheme. On August 30th, a week before the scheduled referendum on the aqueduct, the temperature climbed to 101 degrees. The city had gone its usual 4 months without rain, and there would likely be 2 rainless months to come. On September 2nd, Hearst himself rode down from San Francisco in his private railroad car for a quiet palaver with the city's oligarchs. As men of commerce, they understood each other, and Hearst had recently been bitten by the presidential bug. If he was truly serious about the White House, he could use their help. When the meeting was over, the publisher strode into the Examiner's office, barked Lowenthal into acquiescence, and personally wrote an editorial recommending a yes vote. Samuel T. Clover's Daily News, the only paper on record opposing the aqueduct, lobbed a potential bombshell when it reported that the city's workers, under cover of darkness, were dumping water out of the reservoirs into the Pacific to make them go dry, thus assuring a yes vote. But Mulholland's lame explanation that they had been merely flushing the system was widely believed. On September 7th, 1905, the bond issue passed, 14-1. To the Los Angeles Times, it was a titanic project to give the city a river. To the Inyo Register, it was a ruthless scheme in which Los Angeles plots destruction, would take Owens River, lay lands waste, ruin people, homes, and communities. That sensational headline actually belied the feeling in the valley somewhat. Few people thought, at first, that things would be so bad. A number of the ranchers had made out well selling their water rights, and they would be able to keep their water for years until the aqueduct was built. The city had bought up nearly 40 bank miles of the river and would probably dry up the lower valley, but the upper valley, except for Fred Eaton's purchase of the Rickey estate, had been left mostly intact. When Eaton moved up from Los Angeles as promised and began his new life as a cattle rancher, the valley people were reassured. After a while, they even began to fraternize with him. Mulholland, meanwhile, had begun his own campaign to mollify the people of the valley, a campaign in which he was joined, somewhat more bellicosely, by the Los Angeles Times, which featured headlines such as "Ill-feeling ridiculous" and "Owens Valley people going off as half-cock." Inyo County's Congressman, Sylvester Smith, was an influential member of the House Public Lands Committee, and since the city would have to cross a lot of public land, it would have to deal with him. Meanwhile, Theodore Roosevelt, the bugaboo of monopolists, had just been elected to a second term. He would never let the Owens Valley die for the sake of Henry Huntington, Harrison Gray Otis, and their cronies in the San Fernando Valley Syndicate. On top of all this, the Owens was a generous desert river, with a flow sufficient for 2 million people. It was laughable to think of Los Angeles growing that big. So even under the worst of circumstances, there would be water enough for all. The reasoning was very sensible, the logic very sound, and it was fatefully wrong. There was one person who knew that it was. She was Mary Austin, the Valley's literary light, who had published a remarkable collection of impressionistic essays entitled Land of Little Rain that won her recognition around the world. In the course of her writing, she had spent long hours with the last of the Paiutes, the Indians who had lived in the valley for centuries until they were instantly displaced by the whites. The Paiutes showed her what no one else saw, that order and stability are the most transient of states, that there is rarely such a thing as a partial defeat. In a subsequent book, a novella about the Owens Valley water struggle called The Ford, she wrote about what happens when that incurable desire of men to be played upon, to be handled, runs up against that cult of locality by which so much is forgiven as long as it is done in the name of the good of the town. Mary Austin was convinced that the valley had died when it sold its first water rights to Los Angeles, that the city would never stop until it owned the whole river and all of the land. One day, in Los Angeles for an interview with Mulholland, she told him so. After she had left, a subordinate came into his office and found him staring at the wall. By God, Mulholland reportedly said, that woman is the only one who has brains enough to see where this is going. No sooner had the city gotten